This after, better be good.
After all that brouhaha. Last time I spoke, we talked about the Four Noble Truths. And so I was aware coming tonight how, you know, what comes after the Four Noble Truths is the Eightfold Path. And which wasn't, was sort of where I started in my musings about tonight. And then I realized, in a way, I do want to talk about the Eightfold Path. And I want to talk about it in a little maybe different way, as it appears to me tonight, coming out of what we said about the Four Noble Truths as being not sort of a monument to a thing, but as a realization to live by. So the fourth noble truth being, there is a path, and tends to be seen as there is a path that will lead you to a destination that, you know, we call enlightenment. Which doesn't just seem very interesting to me. It doesn't seem very real. It doesn't seem to have very much to do with this very life that I'm leading. What does seem real is I'm walking. Yeah, you're walking. There's a life happening. And what if it's just talking about that? What if, in a way, the Buddha says, having come from this moment of, hey, oh, look, this awakening is made of all of you. This awakening is made of the ground under me and the bush beside me and the star in front of me and the tree over my head and the grass I'm sitting on. This awakening is made of you and me, which is how I understand what he said. If that's the case, then the Eightfold Path has a different feeling to me. It's like, and you can forget about destinations. Don't worry about destinations quite so much. What about this life that's the very one you're living? What if what you need to do, what you can do to enact, to unfold, to liberate this realization is about how you do this life, is about just noticing how it unfolds. So I loved the Eightfold Path when I thought about it as this sort of magical token folded up. Like, you know those little leather purses? Did any of you girls have those leather purses when you were little that would kind of unfold in a cool way? Well, I was picturing the Eightfold Path as that, you know, that I pull that out of my pocket, I plop it down, and underneath me is this, right, the ground underneath me is this unfolded Eightfold Path. And that then it, the invitation is to act to a way of unfolding that. And so I never remember the eight. This is in the ten. So here's the eight. Here are the eight folds. Yeah, just so that I've spoken them out loud. View, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration. So I don't know about you, but I have a to-do list that goes from here to there and beyond. Yeah? And so I don't see these as intended to be additions to my to-do list, which is already completely unmanageable. Why would the Buddha do that? Would that be helpful? I don't think so. But instead, if what he's offering, what we're offering, what our awakening is offering us is, what if I just only, as I am brushing my teeth, as I am feeding the dog, as I am taking out the trash, as I am teaching a kid, what if I just concern myself with how this is right now? How do I see it? How do I hold my intention? How do I, what is my speech like right now? What does it sound like in my ear? What does it feel like in my heart? Does this breakfast tend towards joy? Does this effort just feel like a load on my shoulders? Or where is it alive? Where is this effort alive right now? You know, that sort of thing. And and I was reminded of Tore Zenji's Bodhisattva's Vow, especially with the gorgeous, gorgeous light of these days and the darkness and chaos that we feel swirling around at the same time. Of Tore Zenji saying, you know, if things just seem to be going wrong and people are doing wrong by you and it all feels like crap at the moment, it's best to bow down. Yeah? This is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways, and I think it's like these eightfold ways, this path, yeah? And then he says, now, the light of the Tathagata, the light of this life right here, the one I've got, you know, the one that feels sort of ragged and tired sometimes, the one that I can't figure out, the one that is so unmanageable, this, the light of this coming forth, this, the thing right now, yeah? My little dog sticking her nose into a plant, into a, what they're called, into a fuzzy leaf plant. What are those?
Lamb's ear.
Oh, yeah, the fuzzy ones.
Lamb's ear?
Yeah, yeah. You know, sticking her nose in there and just sort of keeping her nose in there for 5 minutes. Really? What? Yeah? You know, that, the light of the Tathagata appears before us, soaking into our feet. What's that as an eightfold path? Yeah? When we surrender everything else, when we bow to it, when we let it be what is, this, like this life, then the light of what is soaks into our feet. There it is, right here. The path is lit with it. This is the path, like that. To repeat myself about a dozen times. So now I thought I'd bring in some stories, okay? Because these were the stories that just have come to me over the last few days that seem to me to bear on this. So one of them is the story that we've been taking up downstairs in the 515 time about Tortoise Mountain wakes up. So we have these two guys, monks, who are friends traveling together, and they're they've been practicing really a lot and a long time together, completely different personalities, and they're taking a kind of a in between practice sessions. They're touring around, and it's late fall, and so they're hiking along, and they go up and up and up, and suddenly they're out of fall and into winter, Yanto and Xuefen, and they get to this little cabin on Tortoise Mountain, and snow arrives, and they're snowed in. Yanto, who's this brilliant and impulsive and iconoclastic guy, who does not go for following rules very much, just goes to sleep, you know, snowy outside. He just sleeps for days. And every so often he wakes up and feeds the fire and goes back to sleep. And meanwhile, Xuefen, who has this dogged determination, has been practicing and practicing and practicing, and feels like he can't get it. Is sitting. He's just sitting. And then on the third day, Yanto sits up, sort of wakes up, looks at him, and says, "Get some sleep. What do you think you are, a roadside shrine?" Xuefen touches his chest and says, "My heart isn't at peace. I can't fool myself." After 3 days, you know, sitting inside the snow, and Yanto just, "Whoa! Don't you know that the family treasure doesn't come in through the gate?" Let the teaching flow out from your own breast to cover the sky and the earth. And Xuefen was suddenly enlightened and cried out, "Today, Tortoise Mountain has finally awakened." And they danced around the cabin and celebrated. So what, one thing that strikes me in this story, and there were many things, but one of them that really struck me today was just a sense of tenderness about each of our lives and about the friendship of just doing this together. You know, that what each of us is going to do it in a very particular way. And it's not about this traveling from here to there. It's about this particular way that unfolds under my feet, under your feet, and the ways that we light each other's path right there. That light soaking into our feet, the light of you soaking into my feet, the light of me soaking into your feet. That in our little cabin or wherever we are. And these guys had gone to practice to take refuge from, you know, tremendous trouble in China where they were. Tremendous trouble. Tremendous chaos. So the other thing that struck me about this was that sense of where at the beginning of the story we're told, you know, that they have gone diving into practice in their very different ways, you know, and diving into this cabin, these days of snowed in, this taking refuge from, they have turned away from and taken up this really simple, really rigorous life. And how overwhelming things seem right now in our time and place. You know, how much noise there is, how much busyness there is, how much overwhelming news of difficulty, of suffering around the world there is, and that there is sometimes a time to step away. There's a time to stay engaged, and sometimes there's a time to step away. And that the story then ends up with that those wonderful, wonderful words about, you know, let the teaching flow out from your own breast to cover the sky and the earth. That's no longer retreat. That's not going away, is it? It's coming fully into this right here as it manifests. And then Tortoise Mountain has awakened. There's no solitary little person taking refuge there. It's a big, it's all of us taking refuge, and all of us, all of it coming forth again. There's that. And there's the wisdom of just keeping going. A kind of ruthlessness in it. And I feel that ruthlessness in the Eightfold Path. It's like, forget your long to-do list, but be utterly determined about this. Utterly determined about how this life is. How I'm going to meet this life. Yeah? How I'm going to greet it. How I'm going to respond to it. So there was a little piece in here that particularly wanted to come. So let me see if I find it here. Oh, so during the time, John Tarrant, in his telling of the story, says, Yanto, who was the one who was brilliant and impulsive and iconoclastic, right? Yanto seemed like an anthropologist, as if he came from a world in which time was not strict and life and death were not the main thing, just things among other things. Yanto had once said that he liked to live, that just to live was enough. So who knows, perhaps even sleeping for days was thrilling for him. His kindness, Xuefeng decided, came from the way he relaxed and let time and the moment come over him. He didn't want to be other than where he was, and although he didn't seem to need much himself, he enjoyed bringing others into a similar understanding. Then Xuefeng drifted off into places where his thoughts were lighter than snowflakes and melted before he could grasp them. So how about that as the Eightfold Path? You know, not, there's nothing mushy about it, but there's also nothing heavy about it. Yeah? Letting it be light. So that the second story is one that we took up on Sunday, actually, and to me also bears on this sense of Eightfold Path as just the meeting of foot on the ground, you know, just this, the how of this, rather than the where it's going of this. And this one, also to me has to do with this dynamic relationship of stepping away from the world and stepping into the world. Stepping, you know, sort of into the depths of being timelessly, and then stepping back into time to bring something forth, to be active, to offer. That kind of rhythm fascinated me in all of these three stories. Can you feel that rhythm in the Tortoise Mountain story? That there's this sort of stepping away from the world, stepping into this silence and depth of practice, and then ready to step back and bring something forth, bring something to the world. And so here, listen to this one. And it's not all sweetness and light. Hating herself for being so stupid and clumsy, Chi Yuan Shengdan faced the Buddha statue and wept bitterly. Plagued by nightmares, she put her robes on top of her head, knelt in front of the statue, and said, "I've found what I have an affinity for, and I won't let it go." Day and night she labored and toiled, but still didn't have a breakthrough. One day, meditating in a dark room, it was as though she caught a glimpse of a white sun, which a moment later was obscured again by clouds. Do you see that the similarity with Xuefeng sitting and sitting and sitting and sitting? Yeah, through the snow, sitting and sitting. Won't give it up, I won't give it up. I'm not dropping that bone. Not long after, she was listening to a Dharma encounter in which her teacher, Shiche, asked someone what koan she was working on. So this is like happening off to the side, right? "Who?" was the reply. Might have been a very quiet "who," but in my ear it's just as loud as Yanto's roar. "Who?" Without thinking, Shingon interrupted, "Who is the one who's asking? Who is the one who's responding? Put on your clothes, eat your meal, and do what you will." Shiche, the teacher, asked, "Who is the one who lives in peace with the will of heaven?" Shingon replied by stamping her foot. Shiche said, "Red dust rises from the bottom of the sea." Red dust, our actual action in the world, rises from the bottom of the sea, where there's no action whatsoever, the vastness. And Shingon bowed. So that was how it was for her. And this is not about the right way or the wrong way, is it? It's just this is how it was for her. This life of hers. And it's worth hearing each other's stories like that, I think. Would we want to put a label of Eightfold Path on that? To me, it's just, this is the unfolding of the folds for her, you know, in her life. at that moment. So the third story is about Leonard Cohen. Some of you may have read this article that recently came out in the New Yorker about Leonard Cohen. And I really recommend the article. It's very interesting, and I'm sure you can just get it online, probably. The things a number of things really struck me, and one was a similarity in a way with Xuefeng. Even though you would think of him as more of a Yendo type, you know, iconoclastic and brilliant, and you know, but at least as this story describes him, he has had this kind of dogged determination to explore God, you know, you could say, or in any case to give himself to where he had affinity, like this Chi Wen Xingang saying, I've found what I have an affinity for and I won't let it go. You know, this story of his life is really, it seemed to me, say, because you read it too, you know, the story of someone finding his affinity and not letting it go, you know, for in a number of different phases of a life. So really fascinating that way. You know, he studied with his uncles in his grandfather's synagogue, and studied it all. He said anything, Roman Catholicism, Buddhism, LSD, I'm for anything that works. And so he just like went for it, you know, and he followed his affinities. And then he's living in New York, and he studied briefly at a Scientology center, got a certificate that declared him grade 4 release. And in recent years, he's been doing Sabbath studies at a synagogue right there near LA, talking about Kabbalistic texts, and reading from the pulpit passages from Book of Mercy, a collection of his poems that's steeped in the Psalms. And he says, I participated in all these investigations that engaged the imagination of my generation at that time. I even danced and sang with the Hare Krishnas. No robe, I didn't join them, but I was trying everything. And so he's still doing Hebrew studies. And then for 40 years, he was a student of Joshu Sasaki Roshi, and lived at Mount Baldy for 6 years, I guess, became a monk. Joshu Sasaki Roshi was a problematic guy. You know, he ended up getting into lots of trouble for being, you know, cruelly abusive of people, and in particular women who were his students. So, but he's considered Roshi a close friend, a spiritual master, and a deep influence on his work. And he went up to Mount Baldy and lived there. And, you know, with a very, very rigorous kind of schedule, you know, getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever. And what he said about it was, you're getting up at 2:30 in the morning, cabins are only heated a few hours a day, there's snow coming in under the badly carpentered doors, you're shoveling snow half the day, and the other half the day you're sitting in the zendo. So, in a certain sense, you toughen up. Whether it has a spiritual aspect is debatable. I love that statement. It helps you endure. It makes whining the least appropriate response to suffering. Just on that level, it's very valuable. He lived in this little cabin. He ended up actually being, you know, cooking for the Roshi and living in a cabin that was actually connected to his teachers by a covered walkway. And and he said, you know, the monastery is not a place of serenity and contemplation. It's a hospital. And a lot of the people who end up there can barely walk or speak, you know. So yeah, it's a different, there's no romanticism in this. But he hung out there, you know, as a monk for a long time. And he liked it that Zen was a discipline, a practice of investigation. He said, I put on those robes because that was Roshi's school and that was the uniform. That was, there was something in there that he had an affinity for. And he went for it. You know, without a whole lot of, seems like, a, without a whole lot of illusions about, you know, laying some trip on it, being a perfect representative of the Eightfold Path. You know? It was just, okay, this is what I'm doing. And bad stuff happened in that community. No doubt about it. Meanwhile, what he found there did not cure his depression. And finally, he got overwhelmed by it. And he left. And he wrote, I left my robes hanging on a peg in the old cabin where I'd sat so long and slept so little. I finally understood I had no gift for spiritual matters. That's an interesting statement. Yeah? And a little bit like Xuefeng saying, I had some glimpses, you know, in my life, but I don't know where they went. I don't seem to be very good at this. What am I doing here? You know? So he went off to Mumbai. And went to study with Ramesh Balsekar, not somebody I've ever heard of. Have some of you know anything about him? A teacher of Advaita Vedanta, a Hindu discipline. He spent nearly a year there. And he said, for reasons that he now says are, quote, impossible to penetrate, his depression lifted. Don't you just love that? It's like, who knows what that had to do with, but something changed, you know? So then he'd been living very, very simply and then discovered that his entire fortune that he'd made as a musician was gone, had been stolen. So he needed to go and work, go back to work. And so he dove into making music. And that's pretty much what he's been doing since then. He went into it, at least as this is described, with that same kind of determination and dedication to just go into, like, this was the discipline that was now. You know, it's like, this is what I'm doing now. And so apparently he, his keyboardist said that the preparation was meticulous. We rehearsed very close to the way you would record. We did one song over and over and made adjustments. And you know that song, Hallelujah, that he spent 10 years making that song. I did not know that. So the discipline of song making, you know, his discipline, And he says, we did one song over and over. He was locking the lyrics into his memory, too. Usually it takes a while before a tour gels. Not this one. We went out ready. And they went to, they played 380 shows, and he was already like well over 70, right?
I think it was close to 80 now.
Close to 80, yeah. And he began every performance saying that he and the band would give everything we've got. That's what he said at the beginning of every performance. That's a pretty interesting kind of dedication, isn't it? When we say, we offer this, yeah, for the benefit of all beings. Doesn't sound that different to me, you know? We're going to give this everything we've got. It says he was in his mid-70s, yeah. So anyway, maybe that's enough of that. I would recommend the article to you, and it's just about time to stop. But I was struck again by, what about Eightfold Path? You know, what about Shui Feng walking and walking and sitting and sitting? And what about the nun, Qiyuan Xingan? And what about the comings and goings? What about us? What about your life right now, this life that you've been given? Where, what is this eightfold path that is not a path, a formula for a path to a destination? What if this is a simplification of how we live rather than a complication of how we live? What if it's about trusting what you have an affinity for? I found what I have an affinity for, and I won't let it go. What is it that calls you that deeply? In this time, when things seem so complicated, we get so busy, we get so overwhelmed, we think we need to respond to everything, everything calls out so loudly. How does this sense of path, how can it be actually a hymn in a way to what's beautiful? What's beautiful in your life? How are you going to respond to that?
So we have time for questions and discussion?
Or comments or objections? I'm sorry, I feel like apologizing. It feels like it was really quite a ramble and didn't hold together very well. But
on the left side.
I hope there will be something in there of value. So what does it bring up for you, this ramble?
I guess the examples to me did not seem different from the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
But more in the outcome and not in the upfront plan. More in the recognition of a shout or a song or a stamping of the foot or that. The diligence, the effort, the concentration, the all, it's...
Mm-hmm. Like, that it's effective.
Yeah.
That the Eightfold Path is talking about what's effective. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like somewhere, not in the front, in the mind, but somewhere in the recognition of, yes, this.
Mm-hmm. That this can flower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not formulaic and not... gate.
That each path is so unpredictable in some way, like that.
You know, it almost reminds me, if it's at the end of that karmic thing of the choice, the co-creation in the moments of where do I step? What cliff do I step off?
Yeah.
What do I hold back with? And in almost a recognition of yes, or I don't know. Yeah. It doesn't sound contradictory to me.
Yes.
Please don't take this as a criticism. I just, as a point of interest, when you read the path, you didn't put right in front of anything.
That's true. Yeah.
Was that on purpose?
Uh-huh.
I wondered.
Yeah. So what does that bring up for you?
Oh, I don't know. More just as a curiosity.
Huh. Yeah, yeah.
Because that's sort of, since right goes all the way through the Eightfold Path.
That's one word that's used. Uh-huh. It's not always the translation that's used. And I guess my feeling about that is that if I am trying to hold up something against a measure, then it's not allowing me to inquire openly about what is the manifestation of speech in my life right now. So to me, that if I see those as unfolding under my feet of what is right now, then to me it's more of like someone asking me a question. You know, like, what about your speech right now? What about your livelihood right now? So it's almost as if I feel those in that light soaking into my feet. You know, what about it? What about it? And so, and then I can feel what it feels like. What does my speech feel like right now? Does it feel dead? You know, does it feel preachy often? Does it feel alive? Does it feel like something that could bring joy to somebody? You know, so it's more of a question. What about speech? What about action?
What are the other translations for right?
I bet some of you know them.
Correct.
Skillful.
Skillful is a nice one.
And I think skillful brings up more of the question, because that's what I got when you were saying it. Like about, say, if it's speech. Is this skillful?
But that, even that feels too narrow to me. It's like, I guess the question, if I were going to ask one question, I guess I would bring, I would use life-giving instead of right.
You know, I'm so glad you brought it up, John, because it, boing, it's like, well, what happened to the right word? And, you know, and I sat there thinking, just that word was just so curious to just hear the one word you were saying over and over. Mm. And right has bugged me from day one, because it's all of a sudden there's right all and it's wrong. And set up that duality, which just has rubbed me the wrong way all this time. I'm so grateful you explained that to us.
Mm. Well, and it'll probably, I mean, I think it's worth... I'm glad you raised the question too, because I think then each of us can go, well, what language do I want to use for myself in considering aspects of my life, in considering what do I do with my speech, what do I do with my actions, what about my livelihood, how is it right now? Even what I said, life affirming, it still kind of feels like a yardstick to me. And so it's more like, I remember Thich Nhat Hanh at a retreat saying, when he was explaining to us how we should recite the precepts, saying, okay, some member of the community should say each precept, and then after that precept should say, brothers and sisters, have you studied and practiced this precept over the last 2 weeks? And that always your answer is going to be both yes and no. You know, yes in this way, no in that way. And it's almost like that, it's almost like, how about right speech right now? How about, you know, it feels more real to me somehow.
So I like the Eightfold Path, and it's been important to me and helpful. And so I've been kind of wrestling with, you know, the way you, I say spotted, but you know, the way you describe a way of looking at it. And what I come away with is this sense that if you have the, you know, the very specific items of the Eightfold Path in your mind, and if you take them to heart, then this makes a lot more sense of this is how I live my life, and you know, you don't think about, well, is this right speech? This is just the speech that I have.
It's the speech that I have, and how about it? Yeah. How about it? How does it feel?
But to me, I think that's foundational, and this is, you know, beyond foundational. Mm. And maybe that's not how you intended it, that's kind of the way I made
sense. But that's the way it feels? Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. The thing that I find myself not finding helpful is when we make some image of perfection, and we measure ourselves against our own image of perfection. Because that doesn't seem helpful to me. You know, each of these lives, each of our lives tends toward, is made of awakening and tends towards awakening. And that is just not a belief, it's my observation. And I want to have a, I find in myself an affinity for, an allegiance to that awakening. It's the most important thing for me. And so if that's the most important thing for me, if that's the thing that is real and true and beautiful, then I want to notice in each aspect of my path, how is it? Is it, I don't know. Because I can't, there isn't an end point that I can see. And so the nun's life is beautiful, where she is in her dark, dark place, struggling. Yeah? And then finding, you know, and Zhuefeng and Yanto's life interacting with each other like that, you know, in their own, with their own personality quirks, finding their way to awaken together, you know, that's beautiful. Both of them being imperfect in their different ways, you know, and Leonard Cohen, imperfect in his own different ways, yeah, and making something, making a life, you know, which is very public, so we get to look at it from the outside and have opinions about it. But we also get to benefit, you know, we benefit from each other's lives in such big ways, each other's lives that are never going to be perfectly the Eightfold, but right, this and that. So I totally think those are helpful. And I agree with you that in there's some way they're foundational, because our speech is, as humans, huge, the power of it. It's our powers. Really, the Eightfold Path is looking at how do we use our powers? The power of speech, the power of action, the power of thought, power of meditation. Yeah, Jay, what were you
saying? I was just saying how we manifest ourselves.
Yeah.
What was that?
How we manifest ourselves. How we appear.
What is the particular red dust that rises out of our deep ocean? Yeah.
So Leonard Cohen had that great line in one of his songs, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in.
Yeah.